तद्वारो हि संसारो गुणकर्मणि बन्धना अज्ञानमूला अपार्थोऽपि पुंसा स्वप्नाहि वर्प्यते Translation by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. Through polluted intelligence, one is subjected to the modes of nature, and thus one is conditioned by material existence, like a dreaming state in which one falsely suffers. Material existence, which is due to ignorance, must be considered unwanted and temporary. Translation with repetition. Through polluted intelligence, one is subjected to the modes of nature. And thus one is conditioned by material existence. Like a dreaming state in which one falsely suffers. Material existence, which is due to ignorance, must be considered unwanted and temporary. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. The unwanted condition of temporary life is called ignorance. One can very easily understand that the material body is temporary, for it is generated at a certain date. Because of ignorance, one is put into temporary bodies one after another. For it is generated at a certain date and ends at a certain date after undergoing the six kinds of change, namely birth, death, growth, maintenance, transformation, and whittling. This condition of the eternal soul is due to his ignorance, and although it is temporary, it is unwanted. Because of ignorance, one is put into temporary bodies one after another. The spirit soul, however, does not need to enter such temporary bodies. He does so only due to his ignorance or his forgetfulness of Krishna. Therefore, in the human form of life, when one's intelligence is developed, one should change his consciousness to trying to understand Krishna. Then one can be liberated. This is confirmed in the Bhagavad Gita. Then one can be liberated. This is confirmed in Bhagavad Gita 4.9, where the Lord says, Janma karma chame divyam evam yo vedi tattvataha chaktva deham punar janma naiti mameti sorjuna. Translation. One who knows the transcendental nature of my appearance and activities does not, upon leaving the body, take his birth again in this material world, but attains to my eternal abode, O Arjuna. Unless one understands Krishna and comes to Krishna consciousness, one must continue in material bondage. So in this conditional life, one must surrender to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Indeed, that is demanded. Unless one understands Krishna comes to Krishna consciousness, one must continue in material bondage. To end his conditional life, one must surrender to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Indeed, that is demanded by the Supreme Lord Sarvadharman Pradityaja Mame Kang Saranam Braja. As advised by Maharaj Rishabdeva, Nasadu Manye Yato Atmano Yam Asannapi Kleshada Asadeha. One must be intelligent enough to understand that although one's body is temporary, it will not endure for long, As long as one has a body, he must undergo the pains of material existence. Therefore, by good association, by the instructions of a bona fide spiritual master, one takes to Krishna consciousness, his conditional life of material existence is vanquished, and his original consciousness, known as Krishna consciousness, is revived. When one is Krishna conscious, he can realize that material existence, whether one is awake or dreaming, is nothing but a dream and has no factual value. This realization is possible by the grace of the Supreme Lord. This grace is also present in the form of the instructions of Bhagavad Gita. Therefore, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's mission is for everyone to engage in welfare activities to awaken the foolish living entity. Especially in human society, so that he may come to the platform of Krishna consciousness and benefit by liberation from conditional life. In this connection, Srila Madhvacharya cites the following verses. Dukkha rupo pi samsaro bhuti purvam avapyate yatha swapne siras chedam swayam kritvatmano vasa tato dukkham avapyeta tatha jagarito pitu Jananapyatmano dukam avasastu pravartate. One must realize that the material condition of life is full of distresses. One can realize this with purified intelligence. When one's intelligence is purified, he can understand that unwanted, temporary material life is just like a dream. Just as one suffers pain when his head is cut off in a dream. In ignorance, one suffers not only while dreaming, but also while awake. Without the mercy of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, one continues in ignorance and is thus subjected to material distresses in various ways. Thus ends the Bhaktivedanta Swami charity, Bhaktivedanta Swami translation purport, Canto 7, Chapter 7, Text 27, Srimad Bhagavatam, what Prahlad learned in the womb. Harihi Om Tasmai. This is a very interesting verse, simply explained by Prahlad to his fellow students. But they were only 5-year-old students. Now probably the university students would have a difficult one trying to understand this one. But Prahlad's students were pretty sharp. 5, 6 years old, they could grasp it all. They started to do what? They started to chant. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. We're put into this dreaming state of Maya where we're identifying with our bodies. Therefore, whatever the body experiences, we think it's happening to us. Just like in a dream. One is subjected to different kinds of experiences, but actually we wake up, we find that nothing has changed, but simply we went through suffering and we went through Maybe happiness, different, depending whatever the dream was. It was a good dream or a nightmare. So Prabhupada said that sometimes the spiritual master suffers the karma that his disciples have kindly given to him, or unkindly, depending. And so that sometimes it's like a ride on a roller coaster through hell. And you experience all kinds of weird things, and even if you want to wake up, you can't. It's not like a dream, it's like you're there. So he said that because of his disciples were not all following, sometimes he had to experience this kind of dreams which were meant to pay off the karma. Somehow or another, we get a token or all of the karma, whatever Krishna wants, either by suffering in the waking state or in the dreaming state. So like this, the dreams are a way we can also suffer and enjoy some of our reactions. At the same time, it's only a dream, nothing changed. So like that, in our, the Atma doesn't change. We go through so many births and so many different experiences. So the analogy is used here is like a dream. But when you're in the dream, you're experiencing it. It seems as real as anything else. So right now, we're in this material dream state, within which there's also a dream state. But if we're properly guided by a bona fide spiritual master, we follow the scriptures, then we shouldn't be disturbed by the difficulties we face. In this material life, because it's only a dream. And part of the material life means you have to suffer. It was pretty interesting. A couple places here in the purport, Prabhupada said that you have to, one must realize that the material conditional life is full of distresses. Has anybody here realized that? She didn't yet. Already, how old are you? You've already realized it. To some extent. You raised your hand. Until we realize it, then we get some experiences to help us to realize it. Without the mercy of the Supreme Personality Godhead, one continues in ignorance and thus subjected to material distresses in various ways. We're just in, it was a month ago or so in Mayapur. That time I went to see Nirguna Prabhu, who was my godbrother. I don't know if you know Nirguna, he was an active book distributor and very pleasant devotee. And he was taking some kind of a alternative medicine for curing his cancer, but he had a strange cancer that kind of wrapped around his spinal cord, so they couldn't operate on it because
they fear that he would, that they would destroy his spinal cord. It's all, it was right behind his lungs, and had trouble breathing, different, really complicated situation. But that was the Radhastami, and so then they brought him over to Radha's Abhishek, and although he couldn't stand up on his own, there were some strong devotees lifting him up. He performed the Abhishek. And just before I left, when I saw him, then he said that, actually, now I just realized that, I'm not going to make it. And I feel a big relief. This is a big struggle trying to exist. So this Janmasaku called me up and told me that a few days ago, when he just woke up in the morning and he started chanting, and he had his hands in the air and he was chanting, and like Purma Prabhu was chanting for like 7 hours. He's just smiling. He's smiling and chanting for 3 hours with his hands in the air, laying down on his bed. And then he left. Usually in the hospital, people don't die smiling. Don't know what he was seeing, or if he must have been seeing something very nice. I have a disciple who's she was serving with her husband in a Soho restaurant in England, in London. And then she heard her father went into coma. I don't know, it was a heart attack or a stroke or something. And then so she flew down to see her father, who was in Buenos Aires. And he's in the hospital in a coma. And his mother and sister, maybe some other relatives, were there. When she entered the room, like, everybody's so stressed out because the father's in a coma, he's dying, and don't know what to do. You heard this? And then the sister started shouting at her. You and your Hare Krishna, all these things you're doing. Now look at our father, he's in a coma. Now what can this do? Now what's going to save him? And like this, in Spanish, shouting out at her. So I just got here, let me see what I can do. So then she took the Bhagavad Gita and started reading it to her father. And verses and translations. Somehow, the sister was looking, and as she was reading, and she said, "Mom, look it. Dad's smiling." And the mother said, "No, he hasn't smiled for 10 years. "Oh, really? He's smiling." And then she looked at it and she said, Mamma Mia and Holy Mary. He's really smiling. And then the nurses and doctors, they never saw somebody in coma smiling. But as soon as she would stop reading, then his smile would... So the nurse, the doctor, "We don't know what's happening, but if he's smiling, he must be in a good place, must be." So then the mother, the sister, everybody who was before negative, they took turns in reading the Bhagavad Gita, keep the father smiling. So like this, and finally he also passed away smiling. And sometimes devotees survive. Sometimes they don't. We don't, eventually we all don't. Okay, I understood it.
So part of the reality of this world, everyone who is born is bound to die. Everyone who dies is bound to be reborn. Unless, of course, you surrender to Krishna. When we surrender to Krishna, then Krishna takes us back to Him. I was thinking while I was reading this, it's like a great movie, that here there's people who misbehave, they're put into some kind of a dream state perpetually, but what their dreams are can be monitored by the supervisors, and when they actually become rehabilitated, then they're woken up. Because basically that's what's happening to us. But then, that here we are in this dream state. And we're exiled from the spiritual world. But if we wake up and start to perform our devotional service, and we start to serve Guru and Krishna, then the whole conditional life of material existence is vanquished. And we get transferred back to our eternal life. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he came down very mercifully to deliver all of us. Making devotional service as easy as it's, more easy than it's ever been. Says Govinda Das, that Keval Ananda Kanda, simply giving us the blissful part. The ways in previous yugas, people doing, really, to do deity worship, we need a particular bent of mind to do. Prior yagyas and meditation and tapasyas, devotional service, but a bit difficult, relatively speaking. What to speak of other kinds of yoga where it's really tough all the way. Astanga yoga. So here, in this yuga, some places it says how Kali Yuga is the worst place because of so much suffering. I was reading recently how Mother Teresa, when she saw so much suffering in the world, she actually started to doubt whether there's really, how can there be a God? How can he allow people to suffer so much? Which is kind of shocking because somebody was being proposed to be a saint and she was having doubts whether there's a really God. But she saw some pretty heavy suffering, so maybe it was pretty emotionally hard on her. But in our Krishna consciousness, then we understand that the Krishna, he creates the material world, but he allows it to run an automatic gear. The modes of karma. He only intervenes sometimes. And he can't intervene anytime, but he intervenes usually with his devotees are concerned. He doesn't, since other people, if they're not devotees, then why intervene? He reciprocates. They ignore him, he ignores them. In the 9th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, it explains, although he creates the material world, although everything is under his control, but although he's without it, he's outside of it. At the same time, sometimes he goes in it, but
he's not part of it. So like this, it's very confusing. What is the position? I heard one rabbi wrote a book that, you know, why the good things happen, why the bad things happen to good people. And then he had the speculation that God's a good guy and he made him into a world, but then he kind of messed up and it kind of went out of control and it's like he doesn't really have any control over it. So he's not like all powerful. He's just but actually, maybe that way for Lord Brahma to some extent. Because sometimes things get so messed up in the universe that Vishnu has to come down and straighten everything out. There's this pastime about some heavy wars in the Srimad Bhagavatam. Padma Purana was also some wars. There's a story about the Mura demon, from where Krishna got the name Murari. That he, I don't know if I read how he got his powers. Usually they do some extreme tapasyas and get some blessings, and then, but he had so many mystical powers that was quite amazing. He was very well aware of the difference between the Atma and the soul, the soul and the body. But he was very much inimical to Vishnu. So he became the leader of the demons. And there was a huge interstellar war between the devas, who probably in Christian parlance you'd call as angels, material angels, the different categories of angels. Parshadas are the spiritual ones. But between the devas and the demons. And Mura used his mystical powers so that the devas couldn't tell who was the demon and who was the deva. He made all the demons look like angels. So all of a sudden this fellow angel, fellow deva would attack you. And you don't know who to attack. Sometimes they'd attack. No, I'm on your side. No, so it was like completely, how can you fight if you don't know who's your enemy? I mean, that's kind of what's happening in Iraq now, I guess. People walk on the street and all of a sudden they get blown up because somebody just pushes the landmine button or whatever. You don't know, it's like a guerrilla war, terrorism. You don't know who's your enemy and who's your friend. Sometimes innocent people get killed. But this was a war zone, complete battle. But the demons knew who the devas were, but the devas couldn't tell who the demons were. So the devas were getting defeated. So then Skanda Morgan, who's the king, the general of the devas, he was getting confused what to do. So I think he prayed to Brahma to help out, that they need how can they fight like this? So by Brahma's prayer, then Vishnu, he came into that, flew in on Garuda, and with his Sudarshan Chakra illuminating brilliant light, then it was like everybody got exposed, who's who. And then the devas could, get into fighting. Normally the devas can win, but this was like so many mystical powers that Mura demon had that he was tipping the balance on the side of the demons. But once the devas, when Vishnu came in, then things started to balance out. So then the Mura demon, he came up with a new plot. Since Vishnu had neutralized his illusions, so then he tried another illusion. He came in, disguised as Shiva, who's the father of Murgan, of Skanda. And he challenged Vishnu, started throwing weapons at Vishnu. So then Vishnu knew this is just more a demon in the disguise, in the form as if he's Shiva. So he shoots his Sudarshan chakra, chops off the head. So as the Sudarshan chakra is coming in that microsecond of time, Mura demon leaves the body. So it's already dead. And he creates a new illusion. Now he comes as Durga, the wife of Shiva. And she is very angry. You've killed my husband. Now I'm going to kill you. So now Mura demon, disguised as Durga, attacks Vishnu. Again, Vishnu, so what's going on here? Another, illusion. And then chops off her head. But Mura demon leaves before the weapon comes, so he doesn't get killed. Then he enters into a subtle form and takes over the mind of Skanda. And then maybe not to fully take over, but like influence it, like be there, like almost like haunting him. And saying that your mother and father were just killed by Vishnu. So then even Skanda for a minute got bewildered. And he's like thinking of that I have to do something to revenge from mother and father. So like this, Mora was an expert to create fights between, like he was having the devas kill the devas because of the previously. Now he was trying to get Morgan to attack Vishnu. So then Morgan be killed, it would be an easy job to finish the rest of the demons, the devas. But then somehow Brahma came down and saved Morgan from attacking Vishnu and said, this is all illusion of Mora. Look in Kailash, use your powers, look in Kailash. Your mother and father are there. They're not dead. This was all illusions by Mora. And he looks. Oh, yeah. Hi, Mom. Hi, Dad. This is amazing. That's why the Mora demon was really a tough guy. And finally, Vishnu, he had nowhere to hide, nowhere to go. Then Vishnu finished him off. He was creating this huge interstellar wars. Some people, they have this attitude of, very much inimical to God. So this material world is for these people, and the people who are doing things against the laws of God, and actually they have to suffer a certain amount of karmas. So, like this, Vishnu sometimes intervenes, saves his devotees. But generally, things just going on. If we hadn't intervened, then it would have, been a big disaster in the universe. So Prahlad, he intervened, saved Prahlad's life personally. You have to be pretty special to get a personal intervention. Otherwise, he just kind of does it by remote control or through some other agent. So we're locked into this dream state here in the material world, falsely suffering and sometimes falsely enjoying this material existence. Is pretty, so many big thinkers, they're in this illusion. So somehow we have the task to disseminate this knowledge. And Kali's priority is to somehow divert us one way or another or neutralize us so that we don't spread this knowledge, because this knowledge of the Bhagavatam totally counteracts the effects of Kali. It makes Kali the best age. If you know the science of the Bhagavatam, you know devotional service, you chant Hare Krishna, then Kali Yuga is a great time. You can make spiritual advancement very quickly. But if you're not careful, you don't follow the instructions of your spiritual master and scriptures, then Kali can also put somebody in illusion. Just like the Mura demon put so many people into illusion. We can forget what we're really supposed to be doing. When Krishna consciousness was at its peak 300 years ago, after the six Goswamis and all the Acharyas had preached, then Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur said that Kali approached Sukracharya, the guru of the demons, and said that you have to help me, my age is not getting off. This continues on, and then I won't be able to do my thing, in India at least. And it was spread all over the world. So then Sukracharya said, well, I owe one against Vishnu, because when he took the form of a fly and went into the Kamandalu of Bali to block the water from coming out of his water pot, so that the three drops of water had to hit the hand of Vamanadeva, and then he could make the gift. So to block it, he took the form of a fly and blocked the sprout. Kamandalus have this little spout like a flower jug or something. And so then Vishnu took pusa grass and popped him out from the water pot. And while doing that, he poked out one of his eyes. So since then, just to remind Sukracharya that he was misguiding his disciple, he was an unbona fide guru. He's not one of the bona fide sampradayas. But he's a Brahminical guru. So he has one eye. So he said, since he poked my eye out, I'm going to get back at him. And I'll disturb his movement. So he incarnated as Rupa Kaviraj and spread the Sahajya Dharma, which is that you don't have to practice Krishna consciousness very strictly. You don't have to chant or preach. You just immediately enter into imagining that you're one of the eternal associates and then acting like a dramatical playback of that in your mind. And in this way, it seems like a shortcut. Usually you can imagine you're one of the manjaris or one of the cowherd boys or something. Read some very esoteric books. And so this is called sahajya. They were cheap. They make everything cheap. But it's just an imagination. It's not the real thing. It's another dream state. But actually we want to awaken that real love for Krishna. We want to awaken we want to realize what is our real relationship. But you can go in Vrindavan, and some Babaji will tell you, well, I'll tell you what your eternal relationship is with Krishna. And like this, he'll just tell you that you're this or you're that. But what is the use of that? How do you know it's true? We don't want to be told about it. We want to realize it. We want to see Krishna and see ourselves as a cowherd boy or a gopi or whatever we are, and feel all those emotions and things that we're supposed to feel in that eternal relationship. We don't want to just have some, okay, There was one guy who was told that he was a peacock. Usually the Westerners, they always tell them that as Santa Ras, I guess they figure because we're born in a Western country, we not deserve to be in a higher Ras or something. So they found this devotee in the corner, flapping his arms. And then someone said, you know, what you doing? And then he said, no, nothing. No, they kept, you know, what were you doing that day? You know, like some kind of new exercise? Is it aerobics or something? I think I don't even have aerobics, but anyway. Something, what's he doing? And then they finally revealed that he was told that his eternal rasa was a peacock. He was just like practicing. So like this, cheaters and the cheated. We don't know what Nirguna was experiencing. Maybe he was realizing a lot of things. They say, just looking in the sky with a big smile on his face while he's dying with cancer. There was another person passed away, but now I can't remember who. A little sleep deprived past couple of days. Memory goes down. Where he literally, when he was leaving, he said he would start saying, Krishna, Krishna, you come for me. And then he died. Or Prabhupada or something, I can't remember right now. Prabhupada, yeah, who was that? It was Prabhupada. So Prabhupada came, took him back. So while we're in the dream, we have to come over here in this material world. This is our... We play out our duties. That's why it's important if we can play out our duties, play out our Krishna conscious duties for whatever ashram happens to be, whichever ashram we take to fight this war with, then we have to follow the rules of that ashram. Someone may switch from one ashram to the next. And with whatever ashram we're in, that means then we have to follow those rules. So somebody's in the Grihastha ashram, also have children, have husband, a wife, and they follow those rules to how to make their family Krishna conscious, how to practice within that environment. Grihastha life is considered a responsible life, like Gopal Bhatta Goswami mentions in the Sanskar Deepika. We have a lot of responsibilities. Also responsible to help the temples to survive. Then the brahmacharis are considered, what Prabhupada said, free. Little free life. They don't have so many responsibilities. So we give them spiritual things to do, but materially they don't have so many responsibilities necessarily. So like that, different stages. Whatever phase we happen to be, or ashram we're in our material life, and we follow those rules and we practice our Krishna consciousness. And this way we can awaken our Krishna consciousness. We help other people to be Krishna conscious, that also gives us a bonus. We benefit from whatever people we help achieve. So we also benefit. So people identify with the material world because they have a polluted intelligence. So we purify our intelligence, purify our mind, and naturally we'll be able to see things as they are. So gradually the devotees start to, even before they realize their self, or realize Krishna, they start to get realizations where they can see how the material world is working. they have a deeper, more profound understanding. So gradually the conditioning starts to reverse itself. They're able to tolerate the sufferings and tolerate the enjoying. Some they get intoxicated by enjoying. I remember that one disciple, and he was very poor family. I don't know, he was not a poor family, but somehow he was distressed and he joined in South America. And then one relative, some rich uncle, somebody died and left him like $28,000, which was in South America like a fortune. And he thought, why do I have to stay in Krishna consciousness? So many austerities. Now I'm rich, I can enjoy. So he went out and tried to enjoy, spent all his money. All kinds of new friends came till his money was gone. Totally burned out. Then he came back to the temple without any money. The Lord, he said, you know, anyway, Krishna's so merciful. Doesn't seem to learn, you know, it goes somewhere like this. Material life sometimes can trick us with happiness. I think now I can be happy, and our priority to be Krishna conscious goes down. Then when we're far from Krishna, then Maya sometimes, by Krishna's mercy, lets Maya smash us, and that helps us to remember that, what am I doing here? I was so happy when I was a Krishna conscious person, now I'm in Maya, I'm suffering like anything. But initially you don't think that. Initially you get tricked by happiness sometimes. So one has to be very careful. We want to do everything to please Krishna. We don't want any shortcuts, we don't want any deviations. We just want to do the proper thing, which will be the most pleasing to Krishna. To be sure, that's where we always should consult with the spiritual master. Be sure that things are according to the scripture. So here Prahlad is teaching his student friends, convincing them that they should chant. Like that, each one of us, wherever we are, if you're working or if you're students or in the family, how to convince your children to be Krishna conscious. How to convince your friends, your neighbors, your work colleagues, your when you get an opportunity. I had some disciple who was working for AT&T, and but she was a bit too much outgoing, so people tend to be, had to be pretty, what's it called, tactful, if you're going to. But somehow people knew that she was a devotee. I mean, she knew because she was like, you know, pretty outgoing about it. But I told her to lay low because... But then one day there was a lady came up to her and said, I just lost my mother, father, somebody who was very dear to me. I know that you have some spiritual knowledge and you know about these things. Can you please tell us, how can I meet you later? You can tell me something so I can deal with this better. So, you know, you can be there for people, be there to be able to help. It was amazing. Yesterday when we were flying from LA to here on US Air, I was in 3C and my secretary was in 3E. So then there was a lady sat down in 3D. I said, can I switch with you? So I can sit next to my friend. He said, oh, yeah, sure. We switched. Then there's this lady in the window seat. And she's talking like really loud, and I'm just, you know, gently making some emails on my hand computer. And the guy comes and says, you should turn close your computer off, you know, because we're going to close the door of the airplane. I said, when you close it, I'll turn it off. Said, well, no, we can't close it until you turn it off. Turn it off. That was a total scam. I mean, I've been flying. And then, but this lady's shouting on her phone, yeah, you know, and then I said, you know, get in my case, what about her? I didn't say that, I mean, I didn't say, but he could, like, pick that. I didn't say anything. And But then she got on her case. So then we all turned off our... They were complaining how the door's open. You know, we don't know how, when they're going to close it. Why? Usually, you know, once they close it, they tell everybody to turn off here. We started talking, and then... So they said, you know, we're vegetarian, and she was talking with my secretary from Malaysia. She was fascinated by Malaysia because her mother went to Malaysia or something. But at one point she broke down. She said, you know, she's got this great job and everything. She's going around selling things to Shafra and big companies. But she's suffering so much in her family life and this and that. I don't know what to call it. But she started crying, right? Right in the plane, started crying. And we were talking, and we were saying how we're vegetarian. So vegetarian, okay, you know, but why? And then we explained why we should be vegetarian. And so okay, the animals, the fish are okay, right? There's fish, you know. Then I explained how a fish can eat anything. I mean, they're like scavengers that if there's a dead body in the water, they'll go and they'll eat even a human dead body. So if you eat fish, it's like, oh, don't tell me anymore. I'm never eating fish again. Oh, no. You know too much. If I keep asking you questions, my whole life's going to change. You know? But at the end, she took a Panchatattva and Hare Krishna mantra. So please keep in touch with me. I want to come and visit you in India. It's amazing. Sometimes you meet people. Usually you don't meet anybody. I mean, it's rare, but sometimes you do meet. I met one multi-billionaire that said he was willing to help us. I have to follow up on that one. He had just given $1.5 million to the orangutan calf thing in Malaysia. Save the orangutan. So... you do meet people, and I remember one time I was flying from Calcutta to Bangkok, and I had a reservation in business class, and they said, sorry, but somehow your reservation got lost, and I had to put you in economy, so you have a business class ticket, I don't know what happened, we'll refund you the difference later, do that, you know, anyway. Just starting to travel, so I was a little impatient. What's going on? No, I just take it all. I never know what Krishna's plan is. And I was sitting in the back of the plane, and I look over, and now everybody wears sikas and neck beads. It's like a fashion. But in those days, nobody wore sikas and neck beads. So I looked and saw this devotee wearing neck beads. I mean, I don't know, it's a boy, I saw a young guy wearing shirt and pants, wearing neck beads, and I said, Hari Bol. He looked at me, Hari Bol Maharaj. So how are you? Maharaj, I was trying to, bloop, I was trying to run away, and you're there. Krishna canceled. So like Krishna must have intervened, canceled the reservation. Put me in. How did I end up in that seat right next to two Ayalok Rappas in my life? But these things happen to me all the time. Sometimes I give a class. At end of class, someone walks up to me, Maharaj, who told you about my problem? Why are you picking on me? And I don't know a lot of the devotees here, you know. But this person was sure I was just talking to him. It was just like, we just pray in the beginning. I always pray that Krishna just use me as an instrument. Speak through me. So I may not know even what I'm saying is how it's relating to different devotees, but I may have some special message to them. So like this, we're trying to serve Krishna, be an instrument in his hands, and see how many people we can save. We'd like to right now. This lady was telling us all about this Krishna in the 7 days and the 7 months and the 7 this and that and how there's going to be the Antichrist and all this. And So what we know, there's a 10,000 year golden period, which is just about to start, you know, it's just starting now, it's just a twilight, but we have to actually activate it. She says, that sounds good. So right now we really have, it's important to have all these centers, but how to actually reach out more, Krishna will give us some opportunities. Whenever they come, we should think how to best utilize them for Krishna's service under guidance of Guru and Krishna. Any questions, comments? Sanamini?
You were speaking about how Krishna generally, or Krishna interferes or not interferes, intervenes only in rare circumstances with great devotees. But
not only great devotees, it could be another, it could be any devotee, but not for a demon, not for a demon, it's a man who worries so much.
But sometimes I think, even if I do some stuff myself, or get a parking ticket, or something, why is Krishna allowing this to happen? But by your explanation, I'm seeing that it's very rare, and it's how they're getting fucked up. I think that Krishna's going to be orchestrating every thing in life, so we don't suffer. And we also talk about the material world, we suffer. So through suffering, then we don't have realization.
If it's too nice, you want to stay here. You wouldn't get so. Maybe you want to stay, you know, as a conscious thing because you're a senior devotee. But you may not take it, you know, like so much of a priority to get out. Might kind of start to slide. But you never know. You never know what. Right now, in some countries, we have. A police guy gave a ticket to a devotee. They gave him a book, and he became a devotee. Maybe Krishna wanted you to send you that policeman. Did he take your ticket? Okay, you know, you deserved it anyway. I'm sure they didn't give you a ticket for no reason. But then maybe, you know, give him a book, give him a prasad, invite him to the restaurant. Who knows? Cops become devotees too. I haven't heard of too many in America, but in Europe, there's all kinds of. In England, in Russia, there was this policeman. I got a picture of him, right? You were with me in Russia there, or was he in a... Anyway, he's wearing, you know, this. It was at the farm, at the festival in the Black Sea. I stood with one of these. He's a devotee cop with his uniform. I have a disciple who's on the vice squad in Croatia. So he's always in plain clothes, busting narcos. What a job for a devotee, huh? But he's also a good preacher. The devotee who met me at the airport is an IRS officer. He checks the computers of the big corporations, see if they're cheating. Someone comes in and checks your income tax and comes to the voting. Or whatever it is. Anyway, this material world is meant for suffering. Maybe someone else... It's hard to understand why the things are happening, but here, Arjuna, Prahlad just sums it up, that this material world is meant for suffering, and that's just part of it. Also, when we suffer, we burn off, devotees tend to burn off much more karma than what the suffering that they go through. Like Prabhupada once, he cut his finger, and just one drop came out, and he said, actually, I should have had my head cut off, but I just had to suffer a drop. Who knows how many karmas you burned off by that parking ticket or whatever it was. You're spending Krishna's money on parking tickets. Yes, Prabhu?
This talk a little bit about people leaving this world. world. And as I recall, Prabhupada said something to the effect that he's got 8 million non-human forms. So what I'm wondering is that it seems we have this idea that you sleep too much, you come to air, you know, this thing, the correlation, but you don't go down necessarily to the lowest rung on the ladder, you could say, whether that is in the yoga journey or whatever. So how is that, in other words, if we have to go through 8 million species before we get to the human form, and how is it that when you fall, do you also, many people go all the way down to the lowest possible level and then start to work their way up?
There's a verse in the Bhagavad Gita, I don't have that one by heart, where there's, I think it's in the 16th chapter, the demons and devotees, the demonic. But some people are so demoniac, or maybe it's in the 4th, but some people are so demoniac that Krishna puts them into very low births, so that they just, because they're so much inimical to him and they're so demonic, it puts them down, and they're so far down that it's practically they never get back. But then there's no perpetual, but you know, by the time they work their way up again, and then they're, so what exact birth that is, you know, they start off as a germ again, come up from bacteria to work their way up again, or how it works. But that's because they don't want to know anything about God. They don't want anything to do with spirituality. They want to be in ignorance. It's also given. It's not, they're given what they want. They want to be in total ignorance. So if you're just some kind of really low organism or some low kind of entity that has very little developed consciousness, then you know. So I was in New Taliban farm, they have this farm, 1,300 acres. And so there's some season when I went there, when there were these, what they call love bugs. And most of their life they were together copulating. So maybe there was someone that was really, you know, into sex life and he wants to enjoy it, so just to be a love bug, you know, and that's all he wants to know, or she wants to know. Doesn't want anything else higher in life, so in most of their life that's what they're doing, you know? Seems smashing against your windshield. You know? So there's all different kinds of births for different kinds. I mean, sometimes Prabhupada would look at a particular insect or particular, say, what kind of desire that creature had, you know, that person had to get that birth. Everybody gets the birth that they desired. So if someone, I mean, they had to really be in the mode of ignorance as a human being to become a bear again, you know. Because they really have to just, I mean, really be extensively into sleep, because human life is meant for higher development. So leave a little bit of human life. Maybe they go to church, or they go to the mosque, or do something little, some spiritual. They want to help other people. Something in a little bit of touch of goodness is there. Then you can come back as a human being. But if there's someone's like really totally in ignorance, to such an extent that particular birth is. Fits them right just to the T. That's exactly what they want. Just sleep. Or otherwise, you get cases where people are temporarily in a strange state of consciousness and they take birth. Like Bharat Maharaj, where he got so much attached about his deer, then he died in deer consciousness, but he could remember his previous births. So that was like a rude awakening for him, like how I blew it. So the next life he came back as a Brahmin. In the Purana there's another number of stories like that, different people that might take birth as an animal but they remember. Or just for one, like in the Padma Purana about the fifth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita glories. There's this whole long story how this man was a world-class musician, but because he was such a famous musician, he was the royal musician of the emperor, but he would always have illicit relations with women, because, you know, they're musicians, you know, they're whatever they attract. So then his wife was very upset with him, obviously, and then she decided, at one point she got this strange idea that if she has an affair, then that will make her husband be loyal and faithful. But something happened when she had an affair, and he objected, and then this argument, well, you're doing it, but you're a woman, men can do it, well, you know, whole horrible thing. But then what happened, she got attached to the other guy, which she didn't expect. She was just doing it as a show to get her husband back. But then she became a fallen lady and she was having an affair with some other guy, and then her husband was really getting angry with her and they were having fights all the time. And so then she saw him as an obstacle for her sense gratification, killed him in his sleep, cut his body in little pieces, threw it down into a well. And then the emperor asked, where's my musician? Called her and said, well, he went out for a program, never came back. So declared her after some time, she was declared as a de facto widow, put on a pension. Put on a pension. And she was enjoying life, you know, but showing everyone she's like this very white-dressed, you know, widow, very sacred person, but she was doing all kinds of nonsense on the side. Then she got this horrible disease where she died of hemorrhoids and piles, and she died from bleeding from the anus. She couldn't sit down, she couldn't lay down, she was in terrible pain. So who knows why people, you know, dying, with what they did this life or previous lives. But here they, you know, they trace it out, like, okay. So what happened? When he died, he was taken to Yamaraj for the judgment. And then Yamaraj said that, look, you're a great musician, you rose high in society, you should have used your music to glorify God. Instead, you're using your music to score women. So, whatever, I maybe didn't use that language, but, you know, I can't speak like that in other countries because nobody knows the slang, but... Anyway, too, this is being recorded, so... Anyway, he got sentenced to taking birth as a vulture, because he's a high flyer, but he's a low looker. He flies very high, but he's just looking down for dead bodies, so Prabhupada used that enough. Then when she died, she was taken, and then Yamaraj said, well, you want to show that you're a very pious lady, but you were doing all these sinful things, so you're actually like a, you're like a bird brain. You look pretty like a bird, but you got no intelligence. How to utilize you at this great position in the empire. So she became a parrot. So then it says that the vulture, Jai. The vulture was flying over a forest, a jungle, and sees this parrot fly under him. Then he gets a sudden flashback that the parrot is his ex-wife, who had killed him in his sleep. So he dies, he swoops down and catches her. Then he said, well, you made me suffer so much, I'm not going to finish you off easy. I'm going to make you die a slow death. So using his talons, he's like,
gradually just start tearing her apart, but little by bit, so she's screaming and suffering, and these vultures are much bigger than parrots, this particular parrot in my case. So he got thirsty from all the torturing, and then he saw a nice dead body with a skull upside down, and in that skull there was some water. So for the vulture, this is like nectar drink. So he sits on the side of the skull and he's going to drink the water. The parrot squealing, screaming, screeching. They hear a bird screech, screech. And then some hunter hears and shoots the arrow, and it goes through both of the two, the parrot and the vulture, and they fall down into the water and the skull. Then they get taken back to Yamaraj. So this was just a one birth assignment. It wasn't like a permanent, they didn't have to work their way up, but they were taken back. But then the scribes, the people that are keeping track of the karmas, they're like lawyers or something. They're telling, no, he should, maybe this was some lawyers ago, I don't know. I don't want to curse anybody, but what a job, huh? Universal lawyer for the people's karma. It says that there's accountants there, there's people that keep track of everything. So he said, this person, he hasn't done anything. He was torturing his ex-wife even as a bird. He's like got so much hate and envy in his heart. He's, you know, he doesn't, he should go back into the animal kingdom again or something. And Yamaraj goes in a little meditation, then he has a higher vision. He said, no, both of them are free, they're going back to Godhead. So the man, he said, maybe there's some mistake here, because I really am a bad person. I mean, I'm really bad. I'm bad. How could I possibly deserve to go back to Godhead? What did I do that I could possibly go back? And then Yamaraj says, well, you were sitting on this edge of this skull, which had water in it. And that was a devotee who every day used to chant. It was a skull, that was the cadaver, the skull, whatever, no, it was the skull, the skeleton of a devotee who was chanting the fifth chapter of Bhagavad Gita every day.